The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm a producer and editor here in the Author Events office. And tonight, it's my pleasure to introduce David Zucchino. Tonight's author is a contributing writer for the New York Times. He has covered wars and civil conflicts in more than three dozen countries. He was awarded a Pulitzer Prize for his dispatches from apartheid South Africa and is a four-time Pulitzer Prize finalist for his reporting from Iraq, Lebanon, Africa, and inner city Philadelphia. His books include Myth of the Welfare Queen, a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist's portrait of women on the line, and Thunder Run, the armored strike to capture Baghdad, which he co-authored with tonight's interviewer. More on him in a moment. Mr. Zucchino's new book is called Wilmington's Lie, The Murderous Coup of 1898 and the Rise of White Supremacy. It tells the story of the 19th century North Carolina port city that, while once a burgeoning example of a mixed-race community, exploded into racial violence that erased the progress made by formerly enslaved people and their children. Violence whose echoes still reverberate today. In a recent review in the New York Times, Eddie Glaude Jr. calls this book brilliant and heart-wrenching, and, quote, with economy and a cinematic touch, Zucchino recounts the brutal assault on Black Wilmington. And the most interesting line I found from the review is, what becomes clear, at least to me, is that memory and trauma look different depending on which side of the tracks you stand. And incidentally, that reviewer, Eddie Glaude Jr., he will be here on Wednesday, April 29th, for a free event with his book, Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. Join us. Okay, end of the plugs. Tonight, our author will be in conversation with Mark Bowden, most recently author of The Last Stone, a masterpiece of criminal interrogation. Also a national correspondent for The Atlantic and Vanity Fair, he is the author of Black Hawk Down, Killing Pablo, and The Three Battles of Wannat, among other books. Ladies and gentlemen, won't you join me in welcoming David Zucchino and Mark Bowden to the Free Library.
It's a real pleasure for me to be here with David. David and I go way back. We were colleagues at the Philadelphia Inquirer for many years, and I remember at one point we were both in Jerusalem together in 1988 for the first uprising, the Palestinian uprising, and Dave was with me for about three or four of those days, and then he had to leave, and I was really glad when he left, because David's motor runs a lot faster than mine, and he was practically wearing me out. David and I worked together editing Black Hawk Down into a series for the Philadelphia Inquirer before it was published as a book, and Killing Pablo. So this is a long time partnership. Dave, good to see you.
Great to see you, Mark, as always.
Now, you know, we're here to talk about, you know, your amazing book, Wilmington's Lie. You know, I was just listening to Brian Stevenson, who's a lawyer and an author, someone I admire, and he was talking about the fact that the Civil War and the 14th Amendment did away with slavery, but they didn't address the more pernicious underlying problem, which is the racist myth of Black inferiority. And, you know, there have been a spate of very important books in recent years, sort of opening the eyes for ill-informed old white men like myself to a whole aspect of American history that I was never taught when I was a kid. So I thought maybe we should start by you giving us a thumbnail of the really astonishing story that Wilmington's Lie tells.
Okay, yeah, I'll give you just a quick summary. In 1898, November of 1898, white supremacists overthrew an elected multiracial government in the port city of Wilmington in North Carolina. At the time, was the largest city in North Carolina, and in fact was a crucial city for the Confederacy. It was the last port to fall during the Civil War, and for the last year or so, Wilmington kept the Confederacy alive. So it was a very significant city, and it had a black population of 56%, and it also had a multiracial government. And both of those were very, very unusual for the South at that time, for any city. After a summer-long white supremacy campaign, and by the way, that was the name that the white supremacists gave to their campaign. They were so proud of it. They overthrew the government. They killed at least 60 black men, just shot them down in the streets. They wounded many, many more. They burned down the black newspaper, the Daily Record, which billed itself as the only Negro daily in the world. It wasn't, but it was still a very important, amazing paper. They overthrew the government. They marched in at gunpoint, removed the mayor, the city alderman, the police chief, and other officials, black and white. The blacks they didn't kill. They marched to the train station along with the white leadership, which they called white traitors, and used a coarser term, the N-word, to describe them. Took them to the train station, put them on a train, and said, if you ever come back to Wilmington again, we will shoot you on sight, and not one of them ever came back. So that's the sort of the outline of what happened that day in November.
But there's a lot more. What were the lasting consequences in Wilmington and North Carolina of this?
The main thing the white supremacists were after, they did want to overthrow the government in Wilmington because it was multiracial, and they did want to take back the state legislature. But the most important thing they wanted to do was deny blacks the right to vote and the right to hold office forever. And by those standards, it was incredibly successful. From probably 1898 up until the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965, blacks did not vote in any appreciable numbers in North Carolina. I'll just give you a couple of numbers. In 1896, there were 126,000 registered black voters in North Carolina, 126,000. 6 years later, in 1902, there were 6,000. So you can see how effective this was. In 1998, the entire country had one black congressman, and he happened to be from North Carolina. His name was George Henry White, and he represented a district in southeastern North Carolina that was adjacent to Wilmington. And because he was black and because he was the only black in Congress, the white supremacists hounded him and his family out of office. He just decided he was not going to run for re-election in 1900, and in fact, he decided to leave the state. And he gave a long, rueful interview to the New York Times in which he said, I cannot live in North Carolina and be treated as a man. And from 1900, there was no black citizen in Congress from North Carolina until 1992, if you can imagine that, almost a century later. Right. And three of the 10 city aldermen were black, and when they removed at gunpoint those three black men, no black person served on the council in Wilmington until 1992. So that gives you some sense of the long-term consequences.
And it's important to note that the federal government and the state government did nothing about any of this, including the 60 men who were killed, and there's no one was ever prosecuted for any of these crimes. And it really, I think, set the tone for a whole generation of several generations of Jim Crowism and sort of white supremacist domination of the South. But I wanted to ask, why Wilmington? What made Wilmington, North Carolina, a flashpoint for white supremacy?
It was because it was really, really a mecca for blacks. There was a Baptist publication in 1998 that called it, quote, the freest town for the Negro in the country. You had black doctors, black lawyers, black ministers. You had blacks were, the superintendent of the streets was black, the city jailer was black, the county treasurer was black. There were 65 black professionals, which was highly unusual for a city in the South at that time, doctors, lawyers, and ministers, all educated at black universities. So this was unusual and is obviously more than the white supremacists could bear. Blacks even sold goods from the white city market at the time, and that just did not happen in 1898 in the South, but it happened in Wilmington. So all of this was just an existential threat to white supremacy, and that's why they rose up and announced, by the way, beforehand, during the spring, summer, and fall of 1898, they announced openly that they were going to take over Wilmington and the state by the ballot or the bullet or both, and they talked openly about violence and about needing violence to get it done.
So this story had personal relevance to you, didn't it? Because I know that the first newspaper, your first job, was founded by Josephus Daniels.
Right.
Maybe you can start by telling us a little bit about Josephus Daniels.
Josephus Daniels was the founding publisher of the News and Observer, which is the paper in the capital of Raleigh. Still a very important, influential paper, but at that time it was king of media in North Carolina. Of course, there was no internet or radio or TV, and newspapers was how people got their news, and the News and Observer was the most powerful voice in North Carolina, and that was his newspaper. And he used it to spread a propaganda campaign throughout the spring, summer, and fall of 1898, and other newspapers, other white newspapers, picked it up. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read just a brief passage that sort of
fake
describes
news from the from the 19th century.
Right, exactly. But before I do that, I should mention that my first job out of journalism school at the University of North Carolina was at the News and Observer. And there were all these tributes there in the newsroom to Josephus Daniels. He went on to become Secretary of the Navy and Ambassador to Mexico, and he was just treated as this legendary crusading journalist. Not one person there in the 5 years I worked there ever happened to mention, oh, he was the leader of the white supremacy campaign, the leading white supremacist of his time.
And his son, but doesn't his son Clifton Daniels went on to the New York Times?
No, they're not related. That's a Daniel versus Daniels. But he called the News and Observer the militant voice of white supremacy. So I wanted to mention that before I read this little passage. More than a century before sophisticated fake news attacks targeted social media websites, Josephus Daniels' manipulation of white readers through phony or misleading newspaper stories was perhaps the most daring and effective disinformation campaign of the era. The most sensational stories focused on what Daniels and other Democrats claimed was the, quote, black beast rapist. As a native of the South, Daniels understood implicitly the sexual insecurities of many white Southern males. Already emasculated by Union troops who had occupied their towns, they risked further shame if black men were elevated to something approaching equality. A black man who could vote or hold public office was a man who might, by their logic, become a rival for the affections of white women. Daniels escalated trivial incidents into front page outrages. All that was required was incidental contact between a white woman and a black man. With each cartoon, I should mention that because 25% of white voters at the time were illiterate, Daniels hired a cartoonist to draw these incredibly race-baiting political cartoons so that whites who couldn't read or write could understand the tenets of white supremacy, and some are reprinted in this book. With each cartoon and with each provocative article, Daniels pitted blacks against whites. The day was coming, Daniels wrote in the News and Observer, when white men, quote, will take the law in their own hands and by organized force make the Negroes behave themselves, end quote. A race war was inevitable. Quote, a clash is surely coming between the races, Daniels assured his readers, quote, and in such clashes the white race is always victorious.
So the trigger for the coup in Wilmington was an editorial written by a black editor for the black newspaper in Wilmington. Talk about that for a minute.
His name was Alex Manley, and as a journalist, I was fascinated by Manley. He was an incredibly courageous character. He was the grandson of a white North Carolina governor, and he talked often about how he could have, quote, passed as a white man, and he could have, you'll see his picture in the book, and he adamantly refused. He lived his life proudly as a black man. He was a very crusading journalist. He demanded civil rights for blacks. He demanded that the nation live up to the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments for equal rights under law for its black citizens. He wrote an expose about these horrid conditions in the so-called colored ward of the city hospital and got those improved. But in August of 1898, he wrote an incendiary editorial about two taboo subjects, sex and race. And this was in response to a woman named Rebecca Felton, who was a prominent speaker in Georgia. She gave a speech about what she said was an epidemic of black men raping white women. And she said the solution was the lynch rope, and her quote was, "I say lynch 1,000 times a week if necessary." Of course, this was reprinted in the Wilmington papers and all the white supremacist papers. Manley saw it, immediately sat down and wrote a scathing editorial addressed to white hypocrisy. And he pointed out, one, that black men accused of rape were, in fact, in many cases, the consensual lovers of white women. And two, that white men raped black women with impunity, which happened all the time in the South at that time. And I would like to read just a couple lines from the editorial, which was an amazingly courageous thing to do for a black man at that time, if you can imagine, under those conditions.
Page 88.
Thank you. 88 if you're reading along at home. Quote, this is from the editorial. "Every Negro lynched is called a big, burly, black brute, when in fact many of those who have thus been dealt with had white men for their fathers, and were not only black and burly, but were sufficiently attractive for white girls of culture and refinement to fall in love with them, as is very well known to all. Let virtue be something more than an excuse for them to intimidate and torture a helpless people. Tell your men that it is no worse for a black man to be intimate with a white woman than for a white man to be intimate with a colored woman. You set yourselves down as a lot of carping hypocrites in that you cry aloud for the virtue of your women while you seek to destroy the morality of ours." Now, as you can imagine, this did not go over very well with the white supremacist leadership. And in fact, the article was reprinted not only in North Carolina, but across the South. And there was a bidding war for a while because everybody wanted to get their hands on it. So actually, Manley made a little bit of money because he kept reprinting it. But after it appeared, the vigilantes, the white vigilante militia of the supremacy movement were called Red Shirts. They wanted to lynch Manley that day. And to show you how calculated and premeditated this coup was, the leaders of the coup said, "No, not now. This will have much greater political impact several months later in November." This was in August. They said, "We're going to wait till the November elections, and then we can really use this. And I promise you guys, you can not only lynch Manley, but you can burn down the newspaper." And they did. They didn't lynch Manley. He escaped. He got warnings. He escaped 2 days before the election. And in fact, it was interesting, a white neighbor of his knew that he was going to be lynched, warned him, gave him $25 in gold, and gave him the password that you needed to get through the white sentinels. The whites had militarized Wilmington. And they set up checkpoints all around the city, and they organized it on a block-by-block basis. But with the password, he got through and escaped to Philadelphia, as a matter of fact. He lived 40 years in Philadelphia after that.
All right.
11 the Walnut.
One of the things that is chilling, but in a very odd way kind of refreshing, is the complete lack of euphemism. I mean, there are no apologies for the pure racism, pure white supremacy. I know you talk about Waddell's speech. You want to give us
Yeah, let me tell you who he was. Colonel Alfred Moore Waddell was one of the leaders in Wilmington of the coup and the massacre. He was a former Confederate colonel. He had been a congressman, a U.S. congressman. He had run a newspaper, and he was this fabulous orator. And during the summer, spring, and fall of 1898, he traveled through the Cape Fear countryside giving these race-baiting speeches, inciting white men to attack blacks to prevent them from voting. The night before the election, he gave an absolutely chilling speech. And Mark's right, the N-word appeared in print constantly. It was in all the newspapers. It was used commonly. I was just shocked. It was one of the things that shocked me about the research of the book, that how open and nakedly racist these people were and how proudly racist they were. Mm-hmm. So again, this is the speech to about 1,000 red shirts and other vigilantes downtown Wilmington the night before the election. And again, this is Alfred Moore Waddell. What page, Mark?
161.
Thank you. I knew I would lose it.
I memorized this.
Yeah, okay. That's impressive. Again, this is from his speech to a bunch of whooping red shirts. Quote, "Men, the crisis is upon us. You must do your duty. This city, county, and state shall be rid of Negro domination once and forever. You have the courage. You're brave. You are the sons of noble ancestry. You are Anglo-Saxons. You are armed and prepared, and you will do your duty. Go to the polls tomorrow, and if you find the Negro out voting, tell him to leave the polls. And if he refuses, kill him. Shoot him down in his tracks."
So one of the things, Dave, that really struck me as I read your book was that it's such an astonishing episode from American history.
Right.
And I was never taught this. I didn't know anything about this. So, and you grew up in North Carolina. Why didn't we know about this?
Basically, the white supremacists, on the one hand, they boasted about it. They were proud of it. They wrote about it in memoirs and in letters to each other and newspaper articles. But at the same time, they created the lie that's in the title. And the lie was two things. One, that blacks were planning a riot for the election. And they told everyone that. They printed it in the papers. And they said they were going to rise up and take over the town. And a lot of whites believed their own propaganda. A lot of whites sent their families out of Wilmington for the election because they were afraid of this black riot. The other myth was that they propagated in the newspapers was that blacks were not intelligent. They were certainly not intelligent enough to vote and certainly not intelligent enough to run and hold public office and to make important decisions. They said they were venal, corrupt, and the reason they had to rise up and take over was because this corrupt administration and what they called Negro rule. And when I went to high school and college in North Carolina, not once did any teacher or professor mention this event. It wasn't in the history books. When I was a freshman at UNC in Chapel Hill, the dorm I was assigned to was Morrison Dorm. And I didn't know who Morrison was. Somebody said he was a governor. I didn't care who he was. Years later, I find out he's a character in my book. He was one of the speakers on the white supremacy campaign during that summer who rode through the countryside giving these race-baiting speeches inciting whites to go out and attack blacks. And in fact, he was one of three speakers who became governor of North Carolina in large parts due to the fame that they won during this white supremacy campaign. When I was at school, I went to football games at a stadium called Keenan Stadium. You may have seen it on TV. I had no idea who Keenan was, and again, I didn't care. Years later, I'm researching this book. Again, he's a character in the book. He was William Buck Rand Keenan. He was the head of one of the gun squads that rode through the town killing black men. So I bring this up only to make the point that this really is an ancient history. It's right now. It's the legacy is today. There are almost 30 buildings on the campus of the University of North Carolina named for white supremacists, and many of them were white supremacists involved in this campaign. So I didn't know it, but this book has been following me around for most of my adult life because I didn't know about this until about 20 years ago.
So tell us how you found out about it, and when and why did you decide to write a book about it?
I found out about it in 1998 because the University of North Carolina at Wilmington held some centennial events, and they tried very hard to bring blacks and whites together after 100 years and try to come up with some sort of reconciliation, but they also wanted to burrow down and tell the real story. They wanted to end the lie and the myth that had been going for a century. And they brought blacks and whites together, and particularly the descendants on both sides, and they held meetings, and it worked fairly well. They brought people together. They got a memorial put up in memory of the victims, and they rewrote the state historical marker, which had called it a race riot, when in fact it was a racial coup and a massacre. They changed that. But there was one issue that sort of split the town again, and that was reparations. Because it came up, and many members of the white community just adamantly refused to have any part of it, and it's still splitting the community. I gave a talk there a couple of weeks ago, and It was sponsored by the NAACP, and I was anticipating there would be some whites there who would jump up and say, why are you dredging up this ancient history? Just let it be. But no, it did not happen. But reparations was the main topic, or one of the main topics of discussion during that book talk.
So did you cover this for some reason? What brought this to your attention and made you personally decide to write about it?
Again, in 1998, I read newspaper stories about this centennial, and I could not believe it. Like, how did I not know about this, and how could this happen in the United States of America? So I just said, I've got to write a book about it. There had been one academic book written about it in 1984, but it didn't get a whole lot of attention. So I really just wanted basically to correct the historical record and bring this story to the country. And when I go to other parts of the country, no one has ever heard of this. Yeah. Very, very few people. So that's why I decided to do it, and I just had to wait. I mean, I have a real job writing for newspapers, and I just never had time, and I finally got the time and decided to sit down and do it, and it took about 3 years. And obviously, as you know, it's all on paper. There was nobody to interview, and I'm used to interviewing people live or witnessing events myself. And this was a different experience for me. Everything in here comes from a piece of paper, from a document, right. Which is why it took so long.
And I should say, you know, David is an extremely good writer, and it's a very compelling and dramatic story. He writes a narrative about these events. It doesn't read like a work of academic history. It reads like the work of a Pulitzer Prize-winning storytelling journalist. And, you know, I think that, you know, the question that you said, there were some angry whites who showed up at the NAACP event. Why are you dragging up this ancient history? Why is it important, do you think, for us to read about this history, which has been basically hidden
right.
from us?
Because it's not over. I had really a sinking feeling as I was researching this book. Charlottesville happened in 2017, I believe. And it just occurred to me those very fine people who were marching around with the torches and chanting, Jews will not replace us, would have been right at home in Wilmington in 1898. And since 2016, and you've all seen it, this white resentment, white rage, white hate and racism has been dredged up. And I think it's been sitting there all along. The election in 2016 brought it to the surface. And I think it's terrifying because I see some of these same themes running today as in 1898. The scapegoating of people of color or certain ethnic groups, the demonizing of people of color, setting them up as targets. I mean, I'll give you one example. In 1898, the editor, Alex Manley, in addition to getting many, many death threats, was constantly told to go back to Africa. And just this summer, we had three United States congresswomen of color told to go back to their home countries. Another example is in 1898, whites were told explicitly over and over in this newspaper campaign that blacks were coming to rape their women and take their jobs. In 2015, a certain presidential candidate came down the escalator to announce his run for president and said Mexican criminals and rapists, to use the term rapists, are flowing across the border to take your jobs. So this has all been simmering under the surface, and I don't think we've gone a whole lot of very far from 1898
in some ways. As a country to reckon with this
right.
past. And in Germany, you know, there are monuments to the Holocaust, and children in Germany are taken to tour the concentration camps. That Germany as a country has confronted the Nazi regime and what happened. And in South Africa, which you covered.
The Truth and Reconciliation hearings. Yeah.
There are museums in South Africa to make sure that the young people in South Africa understand the apartheid period. We don't really do that in America.
No, we don't talk openly about race. They talk more openly about race back in 1898 than we do today. They were very explicit about it. And they said why we don't think black people belong. And it's a little more subtle today. And I think it's sitting there bubbling, but I don't think it's addressed. Now, I will give Wilmington credit. They did try to bring blacks and whites together, and they did put up this memorial to the victims with a big sign there that gives the true story. So I give him credit for that, but there is a lot more to be done in addressing openly what's going on. One point we were talking about earlier, you know, today you're constantly seeing these videos of young black men, unarmed black men, being shot dead by police officers. And I understand so clearly why young black men might be afraid of white men in uniform, because in 1898, in addition to having the red shirts, the white supremacists had their own two state militias, the Wilmington Light Infantry and the Naval Reserves. These were state militias. They were the National Guard of the day, but they were led by white supremacists and made up of white supremacists. And they served in the Spanish-American War, but the leaders of the white supremacy campaign made sure they were back in Wilmington in time for the day of the coup, which was planned ahead of time. But at the same time, oh, also, these men were in federal service. They hadn't been mustered out. So they were United States soldiers murdering black citizens in the streets of Wilmington. At the same time, there were segregated black units from Wilmington that were called up for service in the Spanish-American War. But the leaders of the white supremacy campaign made sure that they stayed on a training base in Georgia, hundreds of miles away, on the day of the coup. So the black community was defenseless. You had all these young black men trained as soldiers, trained in weapons, and they are hundreds of miles away, and the blacks were not allowed to buy guns. While whites were stockpiling guns all summer, they refused to sell guns to blacks, so the only weapons they had were some old shotguns and pistols. Many of the blacks in Wilmington were descendants of the colored soldiers from the Civil War. The colored units had weapons, but they were completely outgunned and defenseless.
And there are still statues to the Confederate generals and heroes all over the South. I remember growing up as a kid, and you know, I would hear on news reports or read in magazines Malcolm X's speeches, and I used to wonder, you know, what country did he grow up in? This isn't the America that I know, and apparently he was right and I was wrong.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think we're going to take questions from the audience at this point.
Thank you, David and Mark. Great discussion. Where was the Ku Klux Klan during all of this? Because they had been active 30 years before, during Grant's administration. And then my impression is that they started on the decline in the last decade of the 19th century.
Right.
And then I have an add-on question. There were a number of other episodes like this throughout the South. I think Colfax,
Louisiana.
And how many others were there?
Right. I'm glad you asked the question about the Klan. There was a man named, a black man named Abraham Galloway, who was a slave born in Wilmington. He escaped, stowed away on a ship, and came to Philadelphia, was met here by the Vigilance Committee, which was a stop on the Underground Railroad, and he went back to the South as a Union spy. And he was from Wilmington. He came back to Wilmington in 1868 when there was a statewide amendment under... After the war, all the southern states were required to write a new constitution. And this was the first time that blacks could vote in North Carolina. And Galloway led the effort and got the constitution passed. But that year, during the campaign, the white supremacists of the day in 1868 were trying really hard to suppress the black vote. It terrified them, and they were intimidating blacks in Wilmington. They rode ox carts with ghosts through the city thinking they would terrify blacks. They had ghosts everywhere at the post office. And they announced that they, on two nights before the election, that they were going to really kill the black vote in the city. And Abraham Galloway came up with an informal black militia. They had fence posts and clubs. They met the Klan, beat the hell out of them, drove them out of Wilmington, and they did not appear on the streets of Wilmington until the 1920s. Unfortunately, by 1898, the red shirts rose up, and this was this vigilante, and they were all descendants of Klan, and it was essentially the Klan.
Well, there were also, I mean, this is, what, 35 years, 30 years after the Civil War ended, so there were still Confederate veterans.
Confederate veterans and their sons and nephews, and that's who made up the white supremacy movement in Wilmington. And what's interesting is the white commander, Colonel Roger Moore, of the Klan, in 1868 was the leader of the Red Shirts in 1998. And he failed in 1868, but he succeeded remarkably well in 1898. The second part of your question was... Oh, yeah. There have, as you well know, there have been many so-called race riots in our history, late 19th century, early 20th century. I think Wilmington's pretty unique, and most of these, the spark was a fairly spontaneous outburst of white rage, usually involving alleged contact between a black man and a white woman, in many of these other cases. In Wilmington, it was completely unique. It was premeditated for months. It was planned. It wasn't spontaneous at all. And secondly, not only did they murder blacks, which happened many, many times in other riots, they took over an elected government. And this was, to me, by far the most lasting, permanent, and successful overthrow of an elected government in U.S. history.
I'm a UNC graduate as well. I lived in Erringhouse. Mm-hmm. Dorm, so I'm very familiar with Morrison and James and other memorials to the Confederacy on that campus. I'm also from Wilmington, North Carolina, and it's not a question but a comment, an expression of gratitude for writing the book, because I never knew of the history either until I was living in New York City in my 30s.
Wow.
But I felt it growing up. It was never spoken, but there's a reason I became a civil rights lawyer.
Right.
It's because it was all around us, but there were no words or acknowledgments of the existence of it.
Thank you.
In the mid-80s, I was the first African-American graduate of the private school called Cape Fear Academy. And the names that you have referred to were the names of many of my classmates and founders of the school. But people still, to my knowledge, don't really talk about it. And had you not covered in the book and said that there was a biracial leadership of the government in Wilmington, I would have never known that there was a biracial anything in Wilmington, because the segregation continues to this day.
I think today it's, what, 18%?
Yeah, it was 56% in 1898. It's 18% today.
Okay, so African Americans remember Wilmington.
So thank you very much for the book.
Thank you for sharing your story.
It gives an opportunity for the conversations that we need to have. Thank you.
I wish I'd met you when I was researching my book.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Could you mention or go over about the God-fearing, Bible-toting ministers that brought out and talked racism?
Yes.
And brought it to the forefront and even spoke about it in the pulpits.
Absolutely. That was one of the things that shocked me the most in doing the research for this book. On the day of the coup, white ministers were on the street with Winchester guns participating and joining with these mobs of white men going around killing people. And during the summer and fall of 1898, they gave sermons about Negro domination, Negro rule, and how awful it was and how they might have to use force to overcome it. The coup and the massacre was on a Thursday, and the following Sunday, the white churches were full. Every white minister gave these stirring sermons about how they had been liberated from Negro rule. One even said, "We have taken a city." Another one compared it to the taking of Jerusalem. And they congratulated the red shirts on murdering black men and driving people out of the city. I forgot to mention that during the day of the coup, you can imagine what this must have been like for black families as their men are being slaughtered in the streets, and hundreds of them just fled to the swamps and the woods and to a black cemetery where they thought the white gunmen wouldn't go, and they were out there for 2 nights and 3 days. It was November, it had rained that day, and it was cold. At least one black child died of exposure. And when they felt safe enough to come back to the city, they stayed only long enough to gather up their belongings and flee. More than 2,100 people, black people, fled in the days and the weeks afterwards. Now, the Sunday after the coup, all the black ministers who had survived because they had gone along, they hadn't challenged white authority, they were allowed to stay, and they were shocked that they were allowed to give sermons. And I quote some of the sermons in the book, and they're all, don't challenge white authority, know your place, we'll be fine if we let the whites rule, they know best, just be quiet. It was absolutely shocking.
First and foremost, thank you for this book. I live in New Jersey, and I used to be a teacher, and I used to be an electrician at a campus that's known as the Manual Training Industrial School for Colored Youth. Prior to this book, were you aware of the contributions of Congressman White?
Yes.
The reason I bring that up, because I came across an article that references that school, Congressman White, 1902, New York Times.
Wow.
And it's a great article. I have it here with me if someone wants the copies.
I'd love to see it.
But in addition to that, by the way, Congressman White moved to Philadelphia, died in Philadelphia, is buried in Collinsdale, Pennsylvania, at Eden Cemetery. In addition to that, down in Cape May County, New Jersey, Whitesboro, New Jersey, is named after
Congressman White. Yep.
So I want to thank you for this book, because I came across Congressman White through this article and through everything that he was able to do for the blacks coming out of the South.
Right.
Which included my family.
Really?
Way back when my grandmother came up here with her 12 kids.
Wow.
Okay. From not too far from near New Bern.
Yeah, I know New Bern. Yeah.
Exactly. So thank you.
Wow. Right.
And also thanks to NPR for putting this out. And Philadelphia Library System. Great job.
Thank you for coming out. And you should read up on George Henry White. He was an amazingly courageous man. And there is a biography of him out there. And he was incredible. UNC grad, you said?
UNC grad, journalism school, master's degree.
Oh, wow.
All those years. Can you talk a little bit more to the infighting that was the Democratic Party? Because this was also about ensuring entirely white supremacist Democratic Party for 50, 60 years of our lives that went on to support the most racist president, Woodrow Wilson, which then has lots of reasons for Daniels.
Who spent his youth in Wilmington, by the way.
Yeah.
So you wanted to know, the reason, in fact, that there was a multiracial government in Wilmington was because white farmers had supported the Populist Party in North Carolina. And in the early 1890s, there was a terrible recession, and the white farmers felt that the Democrats, which everyone knows was the party of white supremacy then, and the Republicans were the party of Lincoln and black suffrage, the farmers felt that the Democrats had aligned themselves with big moneyed interests like banks and railroads, and they felt that they weren't addressing bread and butter issues like jobs and their children's education. So they made a crucial decision to align themselves with Republicans, which meant that these poor white farmers were aligning themselves politically with black voters, because it was the black voters voting Republican that helped put Republicans in office. And this came to be known as fusion, and that was the only way the government in Wilmington became multiracial, was through this fusion between the white populist and the black and white Republicans. If that answers your question.
Hi, Mr. Zucchino.
Hi.
It's Catherine. Adrian's friend.
I know you. Thanks for coming. She told me you'd be here.
I just have a question, because thinking about what you were saying around us, no one ever being taught this stuff. I mean, I grew up and was educated in one of the Philly suburbs that is supposedly one of the best school districts in the nation, and heard nothing about this stuff.
Right.
And I'll also say that I'm now an educator. So I was wondering, my question really is, what is your advice to educators or to school districts in general about how to get more of this information out there? Obviously, this is just one of many examples, but it's missing from the narrative. And so how do we get that? How do we sort of start to change that?
That is a great question, because I found out that in the current textbooks, before I answer that? Can I read you from a 1940 textbook, which is just astonishing? This is a North Carolina public school textbook that was taught to children. Then I will answer your question. This was in 1940. This was what school kids were reading, and this was in reference to why, according to this history book, the red shirts and the KKK were necessary. Quote, to put an end to this terrible condition, white people all over the South joined together in a sort of club, which they named the Ku Klux Klan. Members of the Ku Klux Klan, dressed as ghosts, scared lawless men into acting decently. On moonlit nights, these men could be seen on horseback, riding to bring order back into the lives of their people. Such sights frightened the Negroes into living better lives. The names of those men, Negro or white, who had done wrong were listed. The next moonlit night, the Ku Klux Klan would visit these men and punish them according to the wrongs they had done. After this, lawless men were not so bold, and crime became less and less. This was taught to school kids in 1940. I mean, there are people alive who learned this in school. Now, Catherine, in answer to your question, I checked the current school textbooks in North Carolina. They barely mention this event. It's in a couple of paragraphs, and they summarize it, and they still call it a race riot, but they don't talk about the long-term ramifications and what this did to North Carolina and across the South. And in giving talks around North Carolina, I've had so many teachers come up to me, public school teachers, saying, this is not in our curriculum, and in the book we use, because it's county by county, it's not in there, but I teach it anyway. I had so many, and that really, really gave me hope. So I hope teachers everywhere are doing that, are taking the initiative on their own to talk about these, not just Wilmington, but many other shameful episodes in our past that aren't taught, and start teaching them, even if they aren't in the curriculum.
Yeah, I would think a visit like to the African American Museum here in Philadelphia, they would, I'm sure, have curators and experts who would be knowledgeable about this period in Pennsylvania history, so that might be useful.
I also want to thank you for being here tonight.
Thank you.
Question I have is, the society we're living in today, I see some comparisons to what was happening in 1898. Right. Could you talk a little bit about what was going on in Washington, D.C. in 1898? William McKinley was president. Mm-hmm. If you look at that era, it was Grover Cleveland, McKinley, and then T.R. came
right.
in. So I'd just like your talks about what was happening in the nation's capital, and if there was any response at all or any debate right. on the floor, any commentary. What was it like? And do you see any comparison to what happened during McKinley's time to what's happening during Trump's time?
Right. I'm so glad you asked that, because that was one of the points I meant to bring up earlier and I forgot, so thank you. Before the coup, during the summer, when the whites were announcing that they were going to do it, George Henry White went to the White House and met with William McKinley and warned him. He said, they are going to kill us. They are going to overthrow the government. They're going to take back the legislature through fraud. A group of black ministers also met in the White House with McKinley and said the same thing. After the coup and massacre, the same thing happened. George Henry White and these ministers went and talked to McKinley. He did absolutely nothing. I could find nothing in the historical record where he ever said one word in public about what happened in Wilmington. There were cabinet meetings, I found out, where it was discussed, but he did not discuss it publicly. And that was surprising to me, because McKinley was an abolitionist. He served in the Union Army. He gave a speech at the 1888 Republican Convention warning people that white so-called redeemers across the South were suppressing the black vote through the Klan and intimidation. But in the summer of 1898, the peace negotiations with Spain were going very badly. He was getting a lot of political heat for that. American soldiers in Puerto Rico and Cuba were dying of yellow fever, and he was just getting pummeled by Congress and being blamed for not equipping the troops and making them serve under poor sanitary conditions. And I think he made a political calculation that he did not want to antagonize white voters, not only in North Carolina, but across the South, because if he had stepped up and done anything about it, they would have been enraged. And I think it was also a cynical decision. He realized that since he had been elected, whites had done such an incredible job of suppressing the black vote over the 2 or 3 years period, and he was running for re-election in 1900, and I think he realized, well, The black votes helped get me into office now, but they're not going to help me now because they're not voting. So I think for all these reasons, he did nothing. And I will say today, the federal government, this was before Trump, has really stepped in because white conservatives in Raleigh, in the state capitol, control the state legislature. One of the first things they did when they took control was to pass a voter ID bill, and I believe there was one here in Pennsylvania. But before they did, they checked with state officials to find out how many blacks had driver's license, how many blacks voted on Souls to the Bowls, early voting on Sunday, how many voted a straight ticket. And they wrote the law that addressed all of these and a clear attempt to suppress the black vote. And civil rights groups went to court, and the federal courts struck down the voter ID law, and one federal judge said that it targeted African Americans with surgical precision. So the court stepped in and threw it out, and then it came back as an amendment, and it passed easily in North Carolina, and the court struck it down again, saying the primary concern of the legislature was race, and that race and voting were inextricably linked in North Carolina history going back to 1898, so it was struck down. Another example was gerrymandering. In 1898, the whites in Wilmington squeezed the black majority into two black wards to dilute the votes. And just a few years ago, the white conservatives in North Carolina gerrymandered 28 state districts and two congressional districts. They squeezed blacks into these long serpentine districts to basically dilute their votes, the same way they did in 1898. But this time, the federal government stepped in. The lower courts ruled that all of these gerrymanders were racial gerrymanders in direct violation of the 14th Amendment, and they threw them out and forced them to be redrawn. And last fall, the United States Supreme Court upheld it. So this was before Trump, most of this. I hate to think if Trump had been in office and in head of the and Barr would have been head of the Justice Department back when these laws were challenged, I shudder to think what might have happened.
I was part of a group that went to Alabama to visit the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. And there is a museum in Montgomery that's a terrific museum, fascinating and extremely, extremely well done. And they are still also having trouble with the voting situation, identifying themselves and having the right to vote. But I would invite everyone to go to that museum because it's absolutely spectacular and says it all.
Yeah, I've read about it. I haven't been there. I would love to go. I'm sure a lot of people here have probably been.
I want to ask you, you do use the expression ballot and the bullet in your book. And I just wanted to know if that was used back in 1898, that expression.
Yes, it was, openly, in the newspapers.
Thank you.
And on these stump speeches during the white supremacy campaign, that was the phrase they used: we are gonna end Negro rule and Negro domination by the ballot or the bullet or both. Yes, they were very open about it. And as we said before, they didn't hold back then. They were very explicit.
You talk about how the long campaign leading up, very public, very open. What were the black citizens of Wilmington doing then? Did they hear it? Did they flee in advance? What did they say about it while they're waiting for this to come down the pike?
They were terrified. And as I was writing this book, I felt that same, even though I knew how it came out, I just had this sense of dread. And I can only imagine the sense of dread they must have happened because they're reading these white newspapers every day and talking about how inferior blacks are and how unintelligent they are and how they're rapists and how they're going to rise up and take over the government. And I think they felt helpless. They did have Alexander Manly and his black newspaper defending them and pushing back. but I think they must have just felt paralyzed and helpless, and I think they really wanted to believe that this couldn't possibly happen. Even though they're openly threatening this, our white neighbors wouldn't do this to us. I don't think they would. And even Manley, right up before the election, he wrote a column saying, "Don't be alarmed. These are our white neighbors. These people believe law and order. I know they're making crazy statements, but I really hope we can get through the election. If you just go out and vote, we'll get through it." So that's what they were doing, and they just must have felt so helpless.
Hi, this question is addressed to Mr. Bowden. In terms of accuracy and journalistic accuracy, and it's not to do with the book, you said that I believe that slavery is illegal, and I think the amendment reads, and I hope somebody, if there's lawyers in the audience, would help me with that, is that slavery is banned except for people who have been convicted of a crime, which, to my understanding, as far as it goes, is that slavery is, you know, and was perfectly legal if you've been convicted of a crime. And this doesn't seem trivial, because since the U.S. incarcerates more people than any other country in the world, you're talking about, what, millions of people who are, in fact, subject to slavery, if I understand the amendment correctly. Could somebody please help me with this? Thanks.
Yeah, and in answer to your question, I don't know the answer to your question. I do think that it is true that in some states, inmates, prison inmates are put to work. And as far as I know, that's still a practice. I guess, you know, that isn't quite the same as slavery, but I get your point. I don't believe that there's ever any law that would pertain to people once they're released from prison, you know, that they would be enslaved. But I do think that there are work programs in penitentiaries around the country. So, but I do, you know, I'm really, do you know anything, David, about that?
I do know back in the 1890s in North Carolina and around the South, whites used vagrancy laws and other laws to arrest black men. And as soon as they were jailed, they served their sentence by, they would hire them out to white employers to dig ditches and to work. So that is another form of slavery. And you could also say the criminal justice system in modern America in some way, since it targets brown people so explicitly, and they are convicted of crimes where no white under the same circumstances would be convicted, and they are targeted by the police in neighborhoods, stop and frisk. You could look at that imprisonment in broad terms as a form of slavery that never really stopped. And I don't know if that was, I forget who asked the question, if that was the point you were making in the question.
Please join me in thanking Mark Bowden.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.